Today's Tay Show will be on case 90 in the PN Blue, the Blue Rock Collection, or the Blue Cliff Record, the Hikigangoku. Case 90 is Chimon and the Essence of Prajna. Engo's introduction as to what stands prior to the word. Not one phrase has been handed down, even by the thousand holy ones. One thread maintains its continuity before your eyes through countless aeons. It is all pure and naked, with hair erect and ears pricked up. Tell me, what is this all about? See the following. Main subject, a monk asked Chimon, what is the essence of prajna? Chimon said, the oyster swallows the full moon. The monk said, what is the action of prajna? Chimon said, the hare conceives by the full moon. Secho's verse, a piece of emptiness transcends description. This has made heaven and earth remember shunyata. The oyster conceives by the moon. Amazing. Monks ever since have done Dharma battle on it. I want to thank everybody for getting up this morning and coming to practice Zen. Now, we're all still sheltering in place. We're all still under quarantine, and it's easy to lose track of many things. You know, I'm doing my work from home, and it's interesting. I think I'm actually working more than I did before. I get up and I sit, and sometimes I go for a run, and then I'll sit down, and it'll be like 9 o'clock or 8:30, and I'll work all day, you know. At least in the old days, when you drove your car to work, you could listen to WNYC or something and relax for an hour each way. So, you know, we're all under various kinds of stresses, but one thing I notice is that, you know, the time, the sense of time or the sense of ordinary structure sort of disappears. I was talking to my wife and she said, what day is it? Is it Tuesday? And I said, no, it's Friday, you know, and she's normally very together about details like that. But, you know, everything is shifting and it's easy to feel a little bit lost or a little bit disoriented. So I think it's very important to have something like this practice to ground you in your daily life. You know, right now, everything is changing very rapidly. And the world we knew may never be the same. And it's hard to know how to ground yourself or where to ground yourself when everything's changing. I'm sure you've followed if you follow the news, you know that something like 1 in 4 Americans is out of work now. And that's a pretty shocking, we haven't seen that for 100 years, that kind of unemployment. And our work lives are transformed and our personal lives are transformed. I don't know about you, but I would love, after the Saturday sit, I would love to drive into Westfield, New Jersey, and have a Thai meal. That would be so good. Or go to Sukh Sagar here near the campus and have a delicious Indian meal. That would be so wonderful. And that's not going to happen, right? So, you know, we have, I'm still sitting here in Lucy Stone Hall because I think the Wi-Fi is a little better in this building than in my house. It seems to be much stronger here. And And so it's worth driving over here for many reasons. For one thing, it's very quiet, and this is sort of an ideal place to do this. I'm going to get back into my car and drive straight home, and then hang out at the house again. Everything is changing, and the world we knew may never come back, and that is, that is a frightening prospect. It's hard to know what the future will bring, but I find it incredibly wonderful to be practicing together at this moment with all of you. And we've been having evening sits 3 times a week, and tomorrow morning we'll have a Sunday sit. And it definitely helps me deal with all this change to get up and I get up when I'm by myself and I sit, but definitely sitting with other people is a different experience. So thank you all so much for coming, and please rely on your practice as things now and as things move forward. I'm so glad to see everybody here. This is a wonderful koan, especially right now. Let me go back to it. And Mong said to Qimong, what is the essence of prajna? In other words, what is the essence of wisdom? And Qimong said, the oyster swallows the full moon. Now that's a Zen answer, right? I will give you the non-Zen answer in a few moments, but the oyster swallows the full moon is based upon Chinese folk beliefs. So in Chinese folk beliefs, oysters open up during the full moon, and they imbibe the moonlight. And when they imbibe the moonlight, they close up and they make a pearl, right? So the pearl is like a little moon. If you think of pearls that way, it's kind of interesting, right? So an oyster swallows the full moon. The oyster takes the full moon in. On a full moon night, all the oysters open up, take in that moonlight, that clear, colorless, bright radiance, and they make a pearl. So the pearl is like a little moon. And then the monk said, what is the action of prajna? And Qimong said, the hare, the rabbit, conceives by the full moon. So this is also from Chinese folk beliefs. The idea is that rabbits become very rabbit-like and frisky and sexually active on the full moon, and that's when they conceive their young. It's definitely the case that, I don't know about in your neighborhood, but there have been a lot of rabbits in my neighborhood. Now, I actually love rabbits. We have a fox in our neighborhood, so I don't know how long the rabbits are going to stick around, but I was out feeding the birds yesterday, and I noticed two rabbits playing, two cottontails playing, and it was so exciting to see them. It's spring, right? The rabbits are here, and it's, I don't know if it's a full moon or not. They might be waiting for the full moon, but anyway, the Chinese folk belief was that just as pearls open up at the full moon, rabbits, reproduce at the full moon, basically. So that's the koan. The main idea here is, what is prajna? What is prajna? Now prajna in Sanskrit means wisdom, right? So prajna paramita, we have a sutra, it's like the Heart Sutra is the shortest of the prajna paramita sutras, the wisdom sutras. And wisdom is an interesting thing. We all, every culture has a word like wisdom, in our culture too, long before people understood about Buddhism, we had wisdom teachings, right? There's different kinds of wisdom. Socrates sort of himself as a teacher of wisdom in a way. He believed that if people argue with each other in a spirit of, in a search for truth, if I say something and you think about the problems with what I said, we both learn something. And this is interesting, right? I mean, it's actually true that if you are into a conversation with somebody and you say, you make some statement, and the person doesn't necessarily accept your statement, but looks at what you've just said and tries to consider an alternative, and then you answer that person, pretty soon you're in unfamiliar territory. Maybe you've had a conversation like that where after 20 minutes, you're both thinking thoughts you'd never thought before, and you're both seeing into the issue in ways you never thought before. And Socrates was one of the first people to notice that, Plato's teacher, Socrates. And Socrates said this is really a discovery that, you know, once we start talking, we both discover things or uncover things that neither of us ever thought about. And Socrates actually said that, like, that kind of back and forth, that dialectic or dialogue is sacred. He thought it was the route to truth or to wisdom, right? And the Greek word for wisdom was Sophia. So you know, basically, Socrates and Plato were both wisdom teachers. And they thought that when you say something and somebody else says, I don't know if I accept that belief, and you go through this process of dialogue, it's actually, he thought of it as like purification. You're actually being freed from your ignorance, and you're getting closer to the truth, to wisdom, Sophia. And so, you know, basically, if Plato set up a school, and everybody learned how to debate in this way, and they believed that they were producing wisdom. This is the sort of Western way of thinking about wisdom, and it's not stupid at all. You know, the idea that if we inspect our assumptions and we subject them to criticism, we actually learn more. We get better understanding of the world. And if we have gone through this process fairly often, we become deeper people. We become more thoughtful, articulate, clear-headed. We're less liable to say things like you should inject a Lysol into your veins to get rid of the coronavirus and so on. So there's something to Plato's idea of wisdom. And there are other wisdom teachers in our culture too. I remember when I was in, There used to be a series of books they were written by, the titles were Care of the Soul, basically. And the name of the author escapes me right now. But these were like best-selling books back in the 70s. And the author was talking about how to have a self, how to be a self. And he was giving people advice about whether, what does it mean to have a self? You know, we grow up and people tell us you should be a doctor, you should be a lawyer, you know, and in a certain way he's saying you shouldn't listen to any of that, that you have like an inner person that you should listen to. And once you find that inner person, you should take care of that inner person. So this was his idea. You have a soul, this essence of yourself, and once you discover it, you have to learn how to take care of it. Just as you get up and you exercise every morning to stay in physical shape, you need to exercise your soul, you know. Of course, there's other kinds of wisdom, too. There used to be a thing called bookstores. There aren't any bookstores open right now. But in the old days, when there were bookstores, you could go to the psychology rack, and you could find books by Freud or Jung. And Freud also taught a kind of wisdom. He didn't call it wisdom, but he was interested in our conscious processing. And Jung, his student, was really interested in wisdom. Jung thought really, he wanted to draw on all of these wisdom traditions, and he studied them at great length. He studied Chinese thinking and ancient Indian thinking and Norse legends, and he came up with these very interesting ideas and sort of wisdom. It was psychoanalysis, but it was really also like wisdom teaching. So, you know, we meet people and we might say, you know, that's a wise person. Yeah, she gave me wonderful advice. You know, I was uncertain about what to do. I lost all perspective and I sat down and I talked to so-and-so and she said, well, do you really want to do this? And when I heard her ask me that question, I realized I don't. You know, thank you so much. And that's wisdom. So that's the conventional understanding of wisdom, and many cultures' understanding of wisdom. When I was young, I remember also reading this person. I remember reading these books, Black Elk Speaks. I don't know if you've had a chance to read those books, but they're conversations with this Lakota holy man named Black Elk. And Black Elk had these visions, and the visions are fascinating. And if you read these visions, you know, they're visions of how to come out of defeat. You know, the Lakota people suffered from the encroachment of Europeans, and he went through an inner transformation, and he had this vision of universal brotherhood. And actually, the books are wonderful, you know. Lakota people had all these wisdom traditions. When people would get together, they would sit down and smoke a peace pipe. You know, you might have heard that word. They would take willow bark and put it in the bowl of the pipe, and each would smoke, and they would settle their minds, and then they would speak from their hearts. And you know, this was beautiful, beautiful wisdom tradition. So all of this is wisdom. And the word wisdom here is prajna, same thing. So a monk said to Chimon, what is the essence of wisdom? What is the essence of wisdom? And Chimon doesn't say, the essence of wisdom is know thyself. Right? Chimon doesn't say, like Socrates, know thyself. Or he doesn't say, like Jung, you have to meet the stranger in yourself, something like that. He doesn't say dialogue is the secret, or dialectic. He doesn't even say zazen, right? He says, the oyster swallows the full moon. So I'd like to say a little bit about this idea of prajna. You know, in early Buddhist teaching, if you read like early Buddhist teaching, the Buddha too has like wisdom teachings. You know, there's a wonderful book, if you ever have a chance to read it. It's called the Dhammapada. The Dhammapada, and it's a slender book, and you can order it online. There's a number of really wonderful translations, and it's probably 100 pages. But they're sayings of the Buddha, sayings of the Buddha. And actually, they are probably the real sayings of the Buddha, more or less. In other words, many Buddhist scholars think that the Dhammapada is one of the earliest Buddhist texts. So they believe that probably, you know, these were the real words of the Buddha. And if you read them, they're wonderful. I mean, the Dhammapada says things like, you know, all beings love life and fear death. So don't kill, basically, you know? And those kinds of, he says things like, you know, the whether you're unhappy or not isn't your circumstances, it's actually your mental state. You know, things, I mean, he said it much more beautifully than I just did, but he's really saying that, you know, it's not your situation, it's your mental state that matters. And you can read these, and they're wonderful pearls of wisdom, as we say, you know. But, you know, as Buddhism developed, people began to be dissatisfied with this understanding of wisdom. Buddhists have always been engaged in practice of meditation and asking questions about reality. You know, so it's not the case in Buddhism that the Buddha gave us a bunch of teachings and they're in a book and we study them and we say, now we understand the Buddha's way. Even though there is a Dhammapada, and even though the sutras were written down about 400 years after the Buddha died, the Pali sutras, the early sutras, Buddhism didn't stop developing. You know, actually, the Diamond Sutra, the Heart Sutra, many sutras were actually written long after the Buddha's death. You know, the Diamond Sutra was probably written about 500 years after the Buddha died. It claims to be the words of the Buddha, but it really not. The Lotus Sutra, same period. Some of the other sutras that we value were even later, you know, actually. So you know, that's a strange thing. You have the teacher, the Buddha, and then he does give some teachings, and they do get written down. But it's like Buddhists kept adding to the teachings in the Buddha's name. This is an interesting thing. It would be like you have Muhammad, and you have the Quran, but then Muslims would not stop adding to the Quran. They'd say that this is a new Quran, and another could be Quran 1, Quran 2, Quran 3, Quran 4, early in the history of Christianity, all of these people got together and said, these are the stories about Jesus that we're going to keep in the New Testament, and these are the stories we're not going to keep in, and now it's closed. No more additions. So it would be like if that process had never happened, if there were all these stories, teachings of Jesus circulating around in the Mediterranean, and then people kept adding for like more than 1,000 years. They just kept saying, oh, I found some new teachings of Jesus. And you look and they've been written on a typewriter, right? That's sort of what happened with Buddhism. And the reason it happened with Buddhism is because Buddhism has a different idea of the tradition of itself. You know, the teachings of the Buddha are understood to be pointing the way towards a process of awakening that can be explored actually infinitely. Explored infinitely, there's always more to learn about enlightenment. There's always more to learn about consciousness. And as our situation changes, we need new models of how to wake up, new guide maps or guideposts for waking up. So Buddhism understands its job a little differently. You know, rather than just studying the sutras, which we should do, Buddhists have always also been engaged in questioning reality, examining reality, not sitting in a chair in a library, and not in a laboratory, you know, by conducting experiments, but on the cushion, entering deep samadhi. You know, so the foundation of the Buddhist tradition of asking questions about reality is samadhi, non-dual awareness. So much of our knowledge of the world comes from dualistic awareness, right? So we feel, you know, if you go online and you read Wikipedia, you're getting a lot of really useful information, but it's from the standpoint of a separated mind that feels separate from the world around it. So you're learning how to see the world in this separated way. It's very valuable, but it's not the only way to see things. So basically, Buddhists have said, let's that way of thinking is valuable, but it's somewhat mistaken. Because actually, we aren't separate from everything else around us. We're all interconnected, but we don't normally notice that. when we sit down on the cushion and we enter into deep samadhi, eventually what happens is the boundary between ourself and the world disappears, and we feel this deep sense of connectedness. It's like going home. And now we begin to perceive the world very differently. So, you know, if you're talking about the way we experience sound, you can say sound waves go into your outer ear, and they travel down the auditory canal, and then they go into the inner ear, and so on, and set up vibrations, and that sends up impulses to the brain. That's an understanding of hearing that comes from discursive understanding, a discursive model. But, you know, if we're practicing zazen and we're in deep samadhi and you hear something, we have a different experience. We say, oh, you know, when I heard the bird, my sense of self completely disappeared and I became one with the bird. See? That's a different way of experiencing the world. It's a non-dualistic way of experiencing the world. So Buddhism is a tradition with teachings like the Torah, like the Bible, like the Quran, but it has also like this ongoing, you could say, research project, which we are all engaged in here. This ongoing research project, and the sutras are all like writing down the research project of the day. This is our, just as like microbiologists publish articles on mercury remediation, Buddhists make discoveries about what the self is, and so on. So Buddhism is like this ongoing project, you could say. And what happened in Buddhism around the first century of the Common Era was that lots of meditators, people sitting on the cushion and doing just what we are doing this morning, said, you know, I don't really think reading the Buddha's teachings is wisdom. I think wisdom is going where the Buddha got his wisdom. See, if that makes any sense. Studying the Buddha's teachings gives us some indication of what wisdom is, but if we really want to be wise ourselves, we need to go where the Buddha went and do what the Buddha did. And that means leaving behind ideas. And setting them completely behind and experiencing the world in the non-dualistic way. But also, when we begin to do that very persistently, we notice that ideas themselves are not real, that they're just constructed by the mind, and that wisdom is not finding a better idea. It's freeing ourselves from ideas, see? So you can read Care of the Soul, you can read these wisdom teachings, you can read Socrates. But the people who wrote, say, the Heart Sutra said, you know, what we really need are not better ideas, but to get free from ideas. And this was like a revolution in Buddhist thinking. And the sutras, they wrote a bunch of sutras down that were called the Prajnaparamita Sutras. So they said, we teach wisdom, but we don't teach conventional wisdom. We teach what's called prajnaparamita. And paramita means of the other shore. So there's the wisdom of this shore, which is a penny saved is a penny earned, or the early bird gets the worm, or know thyself. That's the wisdom of this shore. But the people who wrote the Prajnaparamita Sutras said that is not really wisdom, as we understand it. To be wise, you need to liberate yourself from conventional ideas supported by language. So they said, don't trust discursive thinking. That's not the route to wisdom. Prajnaparamita, the wisdom of the other shore. So this koan is not about Socrates' wisdom. And it's not about Care of the Soul wisdom. And it's not about, you know, self-help or Jung or Freud. It's about the essence of the wisdom that is beyond words, the non-dualistic awareness wisdom. A monk asked Qimong, what is the essence of this wisdom? this prajna paramita, the wisdom of the other shore. It's often translated as transcendental wisdom. That's not quite right. And Chimon says the oyster swallows the full moon, see? So what Chimon doesn't say is the way we get to wisdom is by studying the Buddha's teachings, even though we should study the Buddha's teachings. And he doesn't say the way to get to wisdom is by engaging in the dialogue or dialectical practices. And he doesn't say the way of wisdom is to make a hypothesis and then test it under controlled circumstances. He says the way to wisdom is to open up like an oyster and swallow the moon. See, that's what he's saying. That's our way to wisdom. And you can say, well, what the hell? What does that mean, right? This is an important teaching, actually. Let me read you something else. You know, there's a wonderful collection of koans that most Americans don't have access to. It's the basis of the koan collection, the Mormon Koan, and the Blue Rock collection. And that collection of koans, or stories, is called Records of the Transmission of the Lamp. Jing De, Records of the Transmission of the Lamp. And it's stories about the Buddha and each of his disciples up to basically the various schools of Zen in China. And it's not of history, it's Zen, right? It's a Zen history with all of what you might expect from Zen, so don't worry about accuracy. It's the language of the big mind speaking. Okay. And this is on Nagarjuna. This is the teacher. Nagarjuna was one of the most important figures in Indian thinking. He was the one who discovered emptiness. Nagarjuna really discovered emptiness. Before, I said a little earlier that, you know, Buddhism doesn't stop with the Buddha. The Buddha does teach emptiness. He does say, he does speak about emptiness. But Nagarjuna came along much later than the Buddha. More than 600 years after the Buddha, and he said, you know, emptiness is the door to wisdom. And he was influenced by the Prajnaparamita teachings. And Nagarjuna was a philosopher who developed this philosophy of emptiness, right? So this is the transmission of the lamp's story about Nagarjuna. It says, the 14th ancestor, Master Nagarjuna, whose name means tree dragon, also called dragon conqueror, was a native of Western India who obtained the Dharma from Master Kapimala at their very first meeting. Later, he went to southern India, where many people in that part of the country had faith in the efficacy of good works. They believed in getting good karma by doing good works. When they heard Nagarjuna expounding the wonderful Dharma, they said to one another, the first thing in life is for a person to have fortunate karma. Followers talk about Buddha nature, but who can see it? The master said to them, if you wish to see Buddha nature, then first you must get rid of your lassitude. One of them asked, is Buddha nature large or small? Neither large or small, replied the master, neither broad nor narrow, without good fortune or retribution. It is not born and it does not die. So he's trying to tell them about wisdom of the other shore. They don't necessarily understand it. Those who heard of a principle so superior all returned to their beginner's mind. So basically when they thought they understood Buddhism, see? They thought they understood the path. They thought they understood wisdom, but Nagarjuna has knocked them for a loop because he said, you know, basically, Buddha nature has has no characteristics at all. So then they're sort of dumbfounded, and they go back to their beginner's mind like they're just beginning again. Then the master returned to his seat and showed them his being, free of delusion. It was like the disc of the full moon. The whole assembly could only hear the sound of the Dharma, but they could see no sign of the master. Among the assembly was the son of an old venerable man by the name of Kanadeva. He asked the others, "Do you know the meaning of this or not?" The assembly answered, "It has never been seen, so how is it possible to know what it is?" Kanadeva said, "What is being demonstrated to us is the master's showing of the essence and form of Buddha nature. How is it possible to know that with the discriminating mind? But the form of the formless samadhi is like the full moon. The knowledge of Buddha nature is vast and clear." See, this is that swallowing the moon. This is the moon is often used as a reference to or a representation of the core of your mind. The enlightened core of your mind is like the moon. And what this little story is saying in mythical language is that Nagarjuna was talking to people who believed that they understood wisdom and that they were wise because they had studied the Buddha's teachings. They read the Dhammapada. And Nagarjuna says, you know, that's not wisdom. That's not what we call wisdom. What we call wisdom is direct encounter with the source of the Buddha's own wisdom. And in Buddhism, this is sometimes called the Dharmakaya, the body of the Buddha, the essence of the Buddha. It's sometimes called Buddha nature, see. And then the little story says that when Nagarjuna, they didn't get it. So they said what Nagarjuna does is he sits down on the cushion, he sits in front of the audience, and he goes into deep samadhi. He goes through the layers of his mind and he enters the core of his mind, which is radiant like the moon. And he shows them. But of course, they can't see. And in fact, it's a little bit mythical. They say they can't see him at all. When he goes into that state, they don't even see him. All they do is hear his voice. And somebody in the audience who kind of gets it and later becomes his Dharma heir says, "Do you guys know what's going on here?" And of course they don't. And he said, "He's showing you what enlightened mind is really like. And it's like the radiance of the moon." And they don't get it yet. But if they keep practicing, they will. So this little story might have been the source for the koan in the Pian Lu. This longer, and this got many complications in the Chinese, in the longer Chinese collection. But the point is, you know, when we, wisdom for us is not, it's very important to study the sutras. As you know, we started a sutra study group. And if you're interested in joining, please let me know. I think it's crucial for people to study the sutras. But, you know, there's something deeper than studying the sutras. And that is basically opening up and swallowing the moon, is what the koan says. And that you imbibe that radiance, and then you act in the world using it as your energy, you could say. So how do we imbibe that radiance? Well, you know, basically, this is something I haven't talked about yet, but it's time to talk about it. You know, when we sit down on the cushion and we enter deep samadhi, if you watch your breath, eventually your mind becomes blank. And that's a real discovery for people. I can remember when that first happened to me. You know, I was watching the breath, and I actually just fell into a deep blankness. And I didn't know what to make of it. But it seemed to last for a long time. And it felt very deep. And, and then it didn't happen for a while, and I forgot about it. But then it happened later when I was training with Genki Roshi. It was a real discovery. You know, I never had experienced emptiness before. You know, normally our mind is preoccupied with the world of form, with the unfolding world of form, this and this and this and this. And because we're preoccupied with the unfolding world of form, we never notice that there's something else. There's something else. It's between the moments of form, or it's behind the moments of form. But there's this blankness there, and it's there all the time. We just don't notice because we're too entranced by the one thing after another. And, you know, when you discover that little glimpse of emptiness, you keep coming back to it if you're working on the Mu Koan. And it eventually becomes this ocean of emptiness. And if you've been practicing meditation for a while, you know that this is the foundation of our practice. So, you know, basically, if you're working with a koan, you might try to think of it as having a message that requires you to interpret. You know, you approach it as a conventional kind of wisdom. And you can understand it that way, but the teacher will say, that's too intellectual. So then you go into deep mushin, and everything disappears, and then you begin to process the koan at a deeper level from your Buddha mind. And little by little, you're transforming the way you perceive the world. You know, so maybe I might give you a koan like, if you have a staff, I will give you one, and if you have no staff, I will take it away. So you go into deep mushin and you start sitting with the cushion. I mean, sitting with Mu on the cushion. Your mind becomes blank, and you say, give, take, give, take, give, take. And after a while, something starts to happen. You know, maybe you begin to think about something in your life. You know, maybe you fell in love with somebody and they didn't reciprocate your affection. You were head over heels in love with this person. And you gave them your heart. And they just said, listen, you know, you're not for me. You're not the person. And you were just crushed. And, you know, you carried that wound with you all this time. And you sit down on the cushion and there it is. It comes back. When you experience your old pain, remembering your old flame, right, you know, you're encountering karma that prevents you from being supple and alert and attentive to the world as it really is. It's like there's a little bit of a smudge on the mirror that you're using to look at the world. And so now you're beginning to, when you work through that emotional injury, it no longer distorts your experience of the world. And you begin to experience the world more openly and accurately, you know, accurately. And we go through this process again and again in koan training. So gradually, the way we experience everything is transformed, and the obstacles that we've carried forward into our lives are eliminated one after another. And it has a transformative power. You know, I've talked about this many times, but I remember once when we used to have sesshin at my house. So Yen and I think Jim was there, and Jaru, and I'm trying to think of who else. But, we would end the sesshin, and everybody would just go out to the street, get in their car, and drive home. It was right in my house. And I remember I said goodbye to everybody and just hearing this sound and thinking, what is that glorious sound that is so beautiful? And I went around the corner. It was just a sprinkler. I could hear, it felt like I could hear every drop of water hitting the grass. And it, every time, it was just this little transparency of light. Every time this water would hit the grass. And my mind, it was just like, you know, if I'd been watching TV, I would have paid no attention. But after a week of doing Zazen, it was like, this is astonishing, how beautiful. So little by little, we begin to perceive the world differently when we're no longer feeling separate from it, and our minds have been clarified or purified. But eventually, what we do is we look back at the mind, at the big mind, and you can't make it happen. But eventually, your experience of mu will change. This blankness, this darkness, will change its character. See? So right now, when we want to swallow the moon, we just swallow mu. See, we go into mu sheen, into that blankness, that darkness, and we swallow mu. But mu is only a transitional appearance of the Dharmakaya, of the moon mind, the luminous, radiant moon mind. It's like when you look at the radiant moon mind without being properly prepared, all you see is darkness. All you see is darkness. It's like if you come out of a room, into a dark room, into the sun, you can't even open your eyes. Well, when you go into Mushin and you look at your true nature, all you see is darkness because you can say your sight, your vision is too crude. Too crude. You can't see it for what it is yet. There's still too many karmic layers in between you and your true nature, so it seems dark. But eventually the character will change naturally, and you will come face to face with the Dharmakaya, with your true nature, with Buddha mind. And that's what this koan is saying, in a way. All we have to do is to keep swallowing mu, you know, keep feeding mu on mu, using mu to dissolve our obstacles, and eventually we will no longer be separate from wisdom. Wisdom will be our own self. And it already is, it's just we don't know it yet. So, you know, things are falling apart. It's a crazy world. And, you know, most people are like the people in this story. You know, they don't see it at all. Nagarjuna walks in and he shows them enlightened mind. And they don't get it. They are going to practice, so that's good. They don't walk away. But they don't understand it yet, right? And that's the thing about Zen. You know, a lot of the time you're practicing for something you don't really know. You're pursuing something you don't really know. And the world is totally unaware. But if I may say so, look at what a crazy world it is. I would say wisdom is missing from our world. And we have all the books, we have all the wisdom teachings. Why aren't we wise? And I think it's because those teachings don't make us wise. What makes us wise is clearing away our obstacles and encountering our true Buddha nature, the Dharmakaya. So, you know, please pay attention. You know, our world, our culture, our society, our global world with its many wonderful achievements is a very confused place, and to some degree it's falling apart. It won't totally fall apart. It'll put itself back together again. But when things fall apart like this, it's a wonderful opportunity to cultivate wisdom, to realize, you know, all of these values that people said were so important are just, often they're just BS, you know? I was reading in a magazine yesterday, or a few couple weeks ago, actually, somebody said, isn't it funny that the economy is crashing because we're just buying what we absolutely need? I thought that was very insightful. I don't think it's wisdom, but I thought it was a valuable thing to say. you know, I have enough clothes probably to get me through the rest of my life, to tell you the truth. And you know, I go to the store with my mask and my gloves on and buy the food I need. And it's true, I have a check coming in, so I pay my electricity bill and the gas. And that's about it. You know, so all of these things that we thought, yeah, and we do need the internet, right? I'm glad we have the internet. But all these things we thought we needed, we don't really necessarily need. And so the wisdom of our culture is not to be trusted, I would say. Please don't trust it. But please trust your own inner wisdom, which you aren't going to find by reading wisdom teachings, but by cultivating the great way, by cleaning up karma on the cushion and off the cushion. It's my opinion anyway. So please take advantage of this crisis to liberate yourself. As to what stands prior to the word, not one phrase has been handed down even by the thousand holy ones. One thread maintains its continuity before your eyes through countless eons. That's the unfolding of form, this and that one damn thing after another. It's not wisdom. But it is all pure and naked, with hair erect and ears pricked up. Tell me, what is this about? See the following. Main subject. A monk asked Chimon, what is the essence of prajna? Chimon said, the oyster swallows the full moon. The monk said, what is the action of prajna? Chimon said, the hair conceives by the full moon. Setcho's verse, a piece of emptiness transcends description. This has made heaven and earth remember shunyata, mushin. The oyster conceived by the moon, amazing. Monks ever since have done Dharma battle on it.